Gangs are responsible for sexual violence against women and young girls. They use sexual violence to terrorize the population and to demonstrate their control.
Violence, chaos, and religious persecution. We look at two very different countries and how international leaders, as well as the Catholic Church, are responding to the needs.
The level of anti-Semitism, the level of hatred, the volume of the outrageous posts was really sobering.
Important developments in court this week. In the sentencing phase of the man convicted of committing the worst anti-Semitic atrocity in U.S. history.
I think being Catholic makes political life much easier because there is an authoritative body of teaching that I can point to.
One of Britain's most controversial members of parliament sits down for an interview with EWTN News. He explains his mixture of Catholicism and politics. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
The Asian people are trapped in a living nightmare. Humanitarian conditions are beyond appalling.
Violence, opposition, calls for peace, international aid, and religious freedom in two countries on opposite sides of the planet with strong Catholic communities. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. We begin with a look at rising rates of violence against Catholics and other Christians in two very different countries, Haiti and Nigeria. We start in Haiti, where gangs are gaining more and more control over the nation's capital every day. Reporter Mark Irons explains.
Gang violence continues to terrorize Haiti. Everyday life can be dangerous, even deadly. This woman describes how she was kidnapped on the way to a market and only freed after a ransom was paid for her life.
They told us they were going to kill us. They didn't give us food or water for days, and they blindfolded us.
Since 2021, some Catholic Church clergy have been among the victims of kidnapping in Haiti, and Pope Francis gave special attention to the country in his Easter message this year, calling on the Lord, quote, "Turn your gaze to Haiti, which has long experienced a grave social, economic, and humanitarian crisis." The prayer is needed now as a surge in gang violence has resulted in more killings and shootings. In Port-au-Prince, the capital city, this woman points out the bullet holes in her front door. Her stepfather was shot amid gang violence, and she's concerned for her children.
I ask for help so my daughters can go to the school. I don't want them to be at the streets exposed to the criminals. They are girls.
Some of the most vulnerable, including hospital patients, are unsafe. Last week, the medical aid organization Doctors Without Borders announced that it has suspended treatment at one of its hospitals in Haiti after some 20 armed men burst into an operating room and snatched a patient. And gangs have used sexual violence against women and children to assert control. They've become more powerful since the killing of President Jovenel Moïse 2 years ago this month. Since then, political stability has spiraled out of control. William O'Neill, a United Nations independent expert on Haiti, says the country is in the worst state he's ever seen. Estimates indicate gangs control around 80% of the capital city.
They rule ruthlessly, kidnapping, extorting, and terrorizing the population. Children cannot go to school, markets are closed, or merchants must pay a tax, quote-unquote, to gangs. Health clinics cannot operate, and the basic activities of daily life can entail great risks.
And the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says there can be no strong democratic institutions in Haiti with the constant violence caused by gangs. He's calling for the creation of a security force to intervene.
And I will continue to push for a robust international security force authorized by the Security Council to be able to help the Haitian National Police to defeat and dismantle the gangs.
Last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with the Prime Minister of Haiti. The country has asked for international help to fight the gangs. Though the U.S. will not send its own security personnel to the country, it does support the growing call for a multinational force to assist police.
And the government can regain control of the country and not have it dominated, as it is in so many parts, by gangs. We're in very active conversations with countries in the region and beyond about such a force.
The ongoing violence in Haiti has worsened a hunger crisis as gangs try to control food supply, markets, and crops. Officials with the United Nations have called not only for greater security, but humanitarian support.
An estimated 5.2 million people, or close to half the entire population, require humanitarian assistance, and this includes nearly 3 million children.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in depth.
The United Nations estimates Haiti needs up to 2,000 additional anti-gang police officers to help bring order to the country. Terror organizations are also targeting Christians, including Catholics and Catholic clergy, in Nigeria. There's been a wave of violence in that African nation this summer. More than 1,000 Christians were slaughtered in the first 100 days of this year, according to the International Society for Civil Liberties and Rule of Law, and more than 700 Christians have been abducted. This past Monday, a priest was abducted near his parish alongside three other people. A ransom is being asked for his return. Earlier in the month of June, at least four priests were abducted. The three shown here were all taken from their parish house or residence. A guard protecting Father Marcellus on the right was shot and killed during his kidnapping. All of these priests were freed several days after they were taken. Father Christopher, who was abducted in the beginning of June, however, has still not been returned. In an interview with our sister media outlet ACI Africa, a priest who did not want to be named said the kidnappers are asking for 50 million naira in ransom, which is equivalent to more than 120,000 U.S. dollars. And while kidnappings are persistent, perhaps the most widely reported attack on Catholics was the deadly bombing on Pentecost Sunday in June of 2022 in Ondo State that took the lives of some 40 people. The most recent report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom recommends Nigeria be listed as a country of particular concern, with Christians and some Muslims facing much of the persecution. Nigeria is the largest country in Africa. At least 30 million of the more than 200 million people consider themselves Roman Catholic. There are 50 dioceses and archdioceses in Nigeria, and despite the danger, churches and seminaries are packed. The country is rife with terrorist organizations, including the notorious Boko Haram in the northeast, Islamic State West Africa province in the north, and Fulani bandits throughout the country. And if these groups aren't targeting religious or civilians, they're often attacking each other. The government has been called ineffective, if not complicit, in the violence. Nigeria's new president, Bola Ahmed Tinubu, was sworn into his role in May of this year. He won the election with just 37% of the votes. The elections themselves foster more polarization in a country that already suffers from long-standing ethnic and religious divisions. Critics raised concerns about voter intimidation, suppression, and violence at the polls. As president, Tinubu must tackle the $103 billion debt, inflation, high unemployment, and exodus of educated Nigerians, the proliferation of terror groups like Boko Haram, and walk a delicate line between the two major religions of Islam and Christianity. The president himself and his running mate are Muslim.
In this particular case, we have two individuals, the president and his vice president, who are Muslims. And there's a sense that that could be a challenge in Christian sectors of Nigeria. Boko Haram is also able to provide financial assistance to many of the people who are living below the poverty line in Nigeria, especially in the northern part of Nigeria. It's also been able to take advantage of the segregation between the Muslim groups and Christian groups, the Muslim groups of the north and Christian groups of the south. So this is also part of the challenge for the Nigerian government.
Despite facing opposition, the Catholic Church continues its work in preaching the gospel and in the strong Catholic tradition of service and hospitality, also providing health care and education. Father Patrick Morrison spent more than 20 years as a missionary in Nigeria. He joins us now to talk about the violence there and current efforts to continue establishing institutions that aid the community. Father Patrick, thank you so much for being with us. You told our producer that there are times you don't wear your habit in Nigeria because it's too dangerous. Can you tell us about violence that you've seen or experienced yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I arrived in Nigeria in the year 2001. In my time in Nigeria, each consecutive year, everything has fallen apart. The infrastructure, so many problems. And at least in the last 10 plus years, jihadist groups, especially in the north, have caused so much problems in people's lives, killings and kidnappings and so many other things. As a priest, even I live in Lagos, which is the economic hub of Nigeria. I've even, when I'm on the street myself walking around, I don't wear my habit because of the dangers of potentially being kidnapped because being identified as religious. And so it's been very problematic for us. And so normally we travel in our vehicles to go from point A to point B. And so the issues of possible kidnappings are always happening almost every day. And in fact, just a few days ago, a priest was kidnapped. And so, but I've had information that has been recently released.
Well, thank God for that. What is the state of the Catholic faith in Nigeria? We know masses and seminaries are packed.
They are. Vocations are very, very large in Nigeria, both not just for priests, but also for Reverend Sisters and nuns. And so it is very popular. And the education, most of the people, I think at least at this time, are having large vocations because of the situations of Nigeria, poverty. And also when you're having a vocation as a sister or a Reverend Father, there is also the prosperity for education. You know, you're educated. And so these are avenues. And so what a better way to be able to practice your faith and also receive an education. So yes, vocations are very large.
That's very interesting, especially as Nigeria is home to the largest seminary in the world. What does that mean?
That means that having such a large vocation, it is also not just within Nigeria, but the church as a whole, the Catholic Church, is able to tap into those resources of both Reverend Sisters and also ordained priests to help around the world. I now am back in the United States, and there are several Catholic priests, Nigerian priests, and also Reverend Sisters who are also helping out in the area that I'm living at, in the primary and secondary schools. And so the vocation support is a wonderful thing to the church.
That's beautiful. And what does it offer? You mentioned education. You mentioned that the poverty is stark. What else does it offer families?
What else does the vocations?
The seminary. Vocations and the seminary. What else does it offer families?
Okay, yes. Being that the Catholic faith is so strong in Nigeria, almost every family would like to have a Reverend Father in their family, and I'm more than happy to have one of their daughters in the Catholic Church. It is such a big thing, and it is also, people will look at you, the mothers and fathers say, oh, your son is a priest. It really brings a wonderful thing to the family.
Well, you shared with us the video of St. Catherine of Siena Clinic that serves more than 1 million people in the Oshodi area, and you're working to make it a state-of-the-art hospital. What are the needs of the people there?
In the clinic operates in a city called Lagos. It's the highest populated city in the entire of Nigeria. Undocumented, or documented, it's around 25 million, but undocumented, we have around 35 million people living in the city of Lagos, and we have a clinic, and we offer our services regardless of race or tribal background, Muslims, Catholics, whatever your background is, it doesn't matter. We offer prenatal care and so many other services that a clinic can offer, but unfortunately, because of the size and the population of the people, we are now inundated with not being able to provide a full service as a hospital. We have all of our we have our blueprints. We have our land and everything to be able to build a hospital, but unfortunately, we are running into problems of raising enough money for that. And this is impactive. Even the government sector of Lagos is asking us if we could expand. And because of the collapse of the infrastructure in the state of Nigeria, it's a problem of coming up with enough money to build a very well-sustained hospital, which we really need in that city of Lagos.
Where you're really functioning as a pillar of civil society, you're also working to build the first Dominican university on continental Africa, and it just got pontifical faculty. What kind of degrees are Nigerians pursuing?
In Nigeria, there almost every type of degrees that they are seeking. Currently at Dominican University, we offer, of course, philosophy, theology, which is the mainstay, religious studies, chemistry, computer science, and mathematics, and so many other types of things that are relevant in today's society. And so we are now trying to build the university too. And we're also, unfortunately, having the issues of raising enough money to build the university. And so right now we have our template, which we used to have in 1994. We opened up Dominican Institute, and that is our foundation to which we're now, we have a license to build the university. And so that is what we're faced with. And so we have many people who want to come to the university, but because of space and the inability to build right now, it's overwhelming.
Well, we see that there are two institutions that need our help. We're so grateful for the work that you're doing, and we hope that Providence will provide you with what you need to get them off the ground. Keep us posted on the hospital and the university, Father.
I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if you would like to find out more about the Dominican University and St. Catherine's Hospital, visit the websites listed on your screen. There's much more ahead among retirements and appointments. The Pope announces a new consistory, analysis of this new group of cardinals ahead, and a big win for the pro-life movement in Iowa State Legislature, and interfaith cooperation helps heal the scars of the worst anti-Semitic attack in American history. Our expert panel up next. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back.
Grief and trauma last forever. But this will hopefully provide some degree of closure, which up to now we have not been able to have.
Reaction to the guilty verdict last month for the suspect charged in the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. Now, this week, in the sentencing phase, a federal jury announced mass killer Robert Bowers is eligible to receive the death penalty for murdering 11 people in a Pittsburgh synagogue in October 2018. Bowers opened fire with an AR-15 rifle and other weapons at the Tree of Life Synagogue, where three congregations were meeting for services. The victims killed ranged from ages 54 to 97. Six more people were wounded, including four police officers. Bowers was found guilty on 63 counts, including hate crimes. An investigation revealed he spent 6 months planning the attack and then later expressed regret he did not kill more people. Expert witnesses testified he was overcome with extreme beliefs about Jewish people, immigrants, and white supremacy. Congregation leaders were relieved when he was convicted.
I am feeling a sense of relief that after 4.5 years, the world has heard again about the horrific acts on October 27, 2018, and the shooter is being held accountable for those awful acts.
With the jury's decision this week to allow consideration of the death penalty, the next phase of sentencing begins on Monday. The jury will decide whether to recommend capital punishment or life in prison after jurors hear about the lives of the people he killed and the impact of their loss on their families and the community. In a sea of despair after this horrendous attack, there was a glimmer of hope that developed within the Pittsburgh religious community. Representatives from many faith groups uniting to fight back against religious bigotry. To talk about that, we're joined by two guests at the forefront of this interfaith effort to combat religious intolerance. Alan Hausman is the president of the Tree of Life Congregation, one of three Jewish congregations which lost worshipers in the shooting. And Bishop David Zubik leads the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us for this important discussion. Mr. Hausman, your synagogue received an outpouring of support from other faith communities, Protestants, Catholics, Muslims, Sikhs, and more. What was it like to see that kind of response from the greater Pittsburgh community?
As a lifelong Pittsburgh resident, Pittsburgh is a big, small town, and we always support each other. But it was at first a little overwhelming to see the support that we received. They weren't standing behind us. They were standing with us, shoulder to shoulder, hand to hand, arm to arm. And I get asked all the time, what were all the religious communities that supported you? And I always tell people the shorter list is who did not support us, because every community did. And we've established some really tremendous long-term relationships with all of these other communities.
That's beautiful to hear. And we have Bishop Zubik, one of your allies. Bishop, after the shooting, you openly denounced anti-Jewish bigotry and asked the faithful to pray for their Jewish brothers and sisters. How else did your diocese reach out to the synagogue and put prayer into action?
Certainly in the days that followed the massacre, we invited all of the members of our diocese to join in prayer for the Jewish community. But we always wanted to make sure that we were present to the Jewish community in many ways. You know, there's a long history of a beautiful relationship between the Jewish people and Catholics in our area, going back to the early 1960s. Dr. Freehoff, who was the rabbi at one of the other temples in the area, and then Bishop John Wright, who was Bishop of Pittsburgh at that time, forged a wonderful relationship. And over the course of all of these 60 plus years, that relationship has only continued to deepen. And I'm just very grateful to all of our Jewish brothers and sisters for the ways in which that cooperation has made us a richer church as well, too, rich in terms of celebration of faith and also a deeper appreciation of the differences that exist between us.
And it seems great friendship. Mr. Hausman, we're almost 5 years out from this tragedy. How have you seen the Tree of Life congregation move forward and find healing and resilience?
Well, it's certainly not easy. Some people say that time heals all wounds. And I would tell you that time allows you to learn how to deal with the grief. Never really heals. And our relationship with these other faiths from around the world has really helped us. It's very helpful on a Saturday morning, a Shabbat service, when someone comes up and says, I'm in Pittsburgh for, and I just felt I had to come and be with you. Or at Christmas when we go join the other faiths, or at Hanukkah and Purim, where they all come and join us in the celebrations. We are no longer separate faiths. We are one. And on a weekly basis, we may worship slightly differently, but at the end of the day, we are one people and we are united in our thought that of peace and love for one another.
That's beautiful. Now, Bishop Zubik, you mentioned that these interfaith relationships existed in Pittsburgh long before the 2018 massacre. How have you kept that alive?
Well, a good example is that on October 22nd of this year, we're going to have a special service at our cathedral, 2:30 in the afternoon, to mark the fifth anniversary of the massacre. Several months ago, I called Rabbi Myers and asked, you know, what his thoughts might be on that. He said he felt it was really important for him to also share that request with the families of the 11 who were killed. And came back with a, you know, resounding appreciation for the fact that we're going to be gathering together at our cathedral, you know, with people of different faiths and even with people who have no faith at all. There's something about Pittsburgh that really wants to come together to support each other. And I think this is going to be another powerful example of us being able to do that, marking the tragic anniversary.
An important thing to do. Now, Mr. Houseman, a report from the Anti-Defamation League says that anti-Semitic attacks are on the rise across the U.S. What do you think is the solution to this rise, and how can other faith communities play a part in the solution? Do you have a position on what might be a good way forward?
I always try to explain to people that the word we need to think about when dealing with people is acceptance. Some people use the word tolerance, and I disagree with that. The word is acceptance. We need to learn to accept people for who and what they are. If they worship differently, dress differently, look differently, that really doesn't matter. The only thing that matters when we look at other people is their behavior and their behavior to us. And we've had over the years, as the bishop said, a great relationship with these other religions, and we learn who they are, we understand who they are, and now we are friends because we realize that there really is no difference. We are all the same people. We may speak a different language when we worship. We may go to a different type of temple or cathedral. We may worship on a different day, but at the bottom line is we really say the same things to our God. And the more we could sit down with people and we could open up a dialogue and get to know one another, the less chance we have of these unusual and bizarre thoughts that come to people without even knowing who they're talking about.
And these unusual and bizarre thoughts have manifested themselves in violence. A question for both of you, starting with you, Mr. Houseman. What do you think about armed guards outside of places of worship and making sure that that's there? There's some legislation that has been proposed on that. What are your thoughts on that as a way to safeguard religious communities?
Unfortunately, it has become a way of life, especially in the Jewish community. You see it throughout this country, throughout the world. We have now become used to it. If we attend services that does not have appropriate security, our members are nervous, and they're generally concerned. It's going to take a long time till our congregants and people feel safe again. This is, this attack is going to be on everyone's mind for a very long time.
Now, Bishop Zubik, what about you? The Catholic community has also suffered vandalism, et cetera. How do you feel about protecting your worshipers with armed guards?
I think this has become a challenge that every leader faces, both religious leaders and beyond, to provide for the safety of all of our people. And certainly we're looking at continuing to increase opportunities to protect our people. It's the line of the day, and I think we have to be able to look for ways that we can protect each other. I think one of the things that's so important to remember, and one of my favorite lines in the Old Testament, is where we say that we are the apple of God's eye. And unfortunately, we've forgotten that. The face of God really does exist in each one of us. There can be no room for bigotry or any kind of prejudice. And it seems to me that the two things that can be steps to remove those kinds of attitudes are empathy and the capacity to listen. Empathy means that we put ourselves in the shoes of the other person. We treat each other as we want to be treated. But the second thing is, it's so important for us to be able to listen to each other. I always say there's a difference between hearing and listening. Hearing is a biological process where we take in information. Listening means that we take it in within our hearts. And I think if we can learn that as a lesson as a global community, then, maybe we can turn the tide that exists, amongst and between people who are different.
Now, Bishop Zubik, some quick additional guidance for pastoral guidance for us. We're coming up on 60 years since the Vatican II released Nostra Aetate letter outlining how Catholics should view interfaith collaboration in our relationship to Judaism. Why is it important for Catholics to build these interfaith bridges and support our Jewish brothers and sisters?
Well, I think that's the challenge that Jesus gave us. You know, the very last words that he spoke when before he ascended into heaven was, "You go out now and make disciples of all the nations." And in part of what the Second Vatican Council called us to do is to realize that every person that we're with, no matter what their religion is, and especially with regard to our Jewish sisters and brothers, we need to be able to see them as they really are, our sisters and our brothers. So this coming anniversary really is a reminder to us that we best not forget that charge that goes beyond what the Second Vatican Council asked of us, but to realize that for us as Christians, that's what Jesus calls us to.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you both for your courage and your leadership and, of course, your time.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
News headlines in the Week in Review are coming up next.
Oak Hill is the first birth control pill to be approved for over-the-counter access.
A sea change in contraception as the Food and Drug Administration approves birth control medication that will be sold in the same aisle as aspirin and eye drops.
Why don't they let me in? I've been there before. I've met with Ortega before. Why not now?
A U.S. congressman renews his request to visit an imprisoned bishop in Nicaragua. And a big announcement from the Vatican about the next wave of new cardinals. We discuss the Pope's picks next.
More significant movement in the states about abortion law tops the Week in Review. In a rare one-day legislative session on Tuesday, Iowa state lawmakers approved a six-week abortion ban along party lines. It was immediately challenged in court. Pro-abortionists and pro-lifers demonstrated at the Iowa State Capitol building during the marathon one-day special session. The new six-week ban replaces current law, which allowed abortion up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. The legislation has some exceptions, including rape, incest, or if a mother's life is at stake. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds issued a statement moments after the bill was passed, saying she would sign the bill on Friday if the court challenge was unsuccessful. The law would go into effect immediately. The Food and Drug Administration approved the first over-the-counter birth control pill on Thursday. Previously, all birth control pills required a doctor's prescription. Drug maker Perrigo will start selling it next year. The price of the drug has not yet been announced. The NATO summit in Lithuania wrapped on Wednesday with no official invitation for Ukraine to join, though President Volodymyr Zelensky was invited to attend. However, President Joe Biden and G7 leaders unveiled a substantial show of support for the war-torn country, offering a joint declaration of support to bolster Ukraine's military capabilities.
NATO is stronger, more energized, and yes, more united than ever in its history. Indeed, more vital to our shared future. It didn't happen by accident. It wasn't inevitable. When Putin and his craven lust for land and power unleashed his brutal war on Ukraine, he was betting NATO would break apart. He was betting NATO would break. He thought our unity would shatter at the first testing. He thought democratic leaders would be weak. But he thought wrong.
While Zelensky expressed optimism his country would be able to eventually join NATO, President Biden was on the record saying he does not think Ukraine is ready to enter NATO. Biden said Russia's war in Ukraine needs to end before the alliance can consider granting Ukraine membership. A big announcement last Sunday from the Vatican. Pope Francis has named 21 new cardinals. A consistory to elevate them will take place on September 30th. It will be the Pope's ninth consistory in the 10 years of his pontificate, solidifying his influence over the conclave that will eventually choose his successor. Of note, included in the 21 new cardinals are Archbishop Robert Francis Prevost of the United States. He was the prefect of the Dicastery for Bishops. Archbishop Victor Manuel Fernandez of Argentina, the newly named prefect for the Dicastery of the Doctrine of the Faith, who was elevated just weeks after the announcement of his new post. Archbishop Claudio Guerrotti of Italy, the prefect for the Dicastery for the Oriental Churches. He was formerly the nuncio to Ukraine and Belarus and knows the Russian world very well. Archbishop Christophe Pierre of France, the current apostolic nuncio to the United States as well, and Bishop Américo Emmanuel Alves Aguiar, auxiliary bishop of Lisbon, Portugal, and the current organizer of next month's World Youth Day. And late last week, the Vatican also published the names of those selected to participate in the upcoming Synod on Synodality in October. More than 360 people will be able to vote on matters involving the future of the Catholic Church, including, for the first time, lay people and women. Nearly a third were selected directly by Pope Francis. During the month-long assembly, the delegates will discuss such controversial topics as women deacons, LGBTQ outreach, and priestly celibacy. The assembly will continue with a second session in October 2024, after which delegates will vote on a final document of recommendations to be given to Pope Francis. A.C. Vimmer, the editor-in-chief of our sister agency, CNA Deutsch, joins us to discuss the new cardinals and the synod selections. Thank you so much for joining us, A.C. Let's start with the synod picks. Of the Americans chosen by Pope Francis, Cardinal Supich and Cardinal Mueller are the most stark in their differences. Cardinal Supich gave an interview this week asking questions about the role of women in liturgy, as well as about same-sex blessings, issues Cardinal Mueller has clearly opposed. What does this tell us about what we can expect from the October gathering?
Look, Monsieur, I think that's exactly the question we need to ask, looking at these two people. I've actually just filed a story on the interview, and what in particular Cardinal Kupich was actually saying with diocesan German media, very carefully worded, I might add, about the German synodal way as well. And what you're seeing is that under the surface, where there's a lot of loquaciousness at the top, the same issues come to the boil, and they will have to be discussed at the Synod. They're not going to go away.
Absolutely not. Well, let's move on to the consistory in September. One of the most talked about picks is the new prefect of the Doctrine Dicastery, Cardinal-elect Fernandez, a close advisor of Pope Francis. His change of heart on the way he treated clergy abuse cases in Argentina has recently broken into secular media. What can you tell us about this?
There's been a lot of coverage about what he may have done, and there are a lot of concerns being raised by critics, such as Bishop Accountability, as we've reported. But, Monsieur, the other thing is that at the same time that the diocese has come out in defense of the former Archbishop of La Plata, Fernandez, you're seeing that he himself has said in an interview that he would not handle things the way that he did in the past. Perhaps a good clue about how this might progress is in the words of the Holy Father himself. He wrote a letter to Archbishop Fernandez when he was appointed to this important role, which is, after all, responsible for handling sexual abuse cases in the Vatican for the whole Catholic Church. And he said, "Let those things be handled by the relevant section. I want you, Archbishop Fernandez, Cardinal-elect Fernandez now, just a week later, I want you to focus on dogma and on theology." So perhaps that's the clue that we need to follow here, and we certainly will.
Where he's not necessarily the one that actually is hands-on on these issues. You know, AC, earlier in this program, we discussed the troubles in Nigeria, and we know that there are big picks coming out of Africa. What can you tell us about the three African cardinals chosen, knowing that a lot of the time Africa gets touted as the future of the church?
Look, it sure does. And in terms of our work, we see this demographically, politically, geographically, in all sorts of ways. But when you look at the numbers appointed, critics might point quickly out that out of the 21 cardinals, there are only three Africans coming here. And that's not a lot when you have nine from Europe, when you have five from the Americas and three from Asia. But at the same time, those three, in terms of what they represent, are very telling and interesting. So firstly, and perhaps most notably with regards to the classic factors about the future of the church, you have someone who was Archbishop Protase Rugambwa, who was working at the Vatican in the Dicastery for Evangelization. He's now in Tanzania in a metropolitan archdiocese that's very important in a country where the Catholic faith is flourishing and growing, where the kind of future can really be felt. I was talking to colleagues in Kenya, and they were saying it about the neighboring countries, that Tanzania is one of those countries where you can really sense that coming along. But the other two appointments are interesting as well. You've got Stephen Brisling in Cape Town. He's a white South African bishop who's much loved by all, irrespective of skin color or tribal or other heritage. In South Africa, he's an important voice for Southern Africa. That's geographically important. But he's also someone who's considered to build a pastoral and dogmatic bridge quite easily. And then you've got someone who's dealing with something that's very particular to Africa, the tribal issues. And that's, of course, Archbishop Stephen Ameyo Martin of Juba in South Sudan, who's seen some significant contradiction and protest and critics coming out to his appointment. But Pope Francis has gone ahead and affirmed that. And perhaps giving him the red hat now as a cardinal gives him a particular further edge and certainly a bit of more papal authority, if you like, that this is his bailiwick, this is his diocese, and that is the role that he has to play, crossing boundaries, crossing tribal issues and tensions.
Absolutely, and also dealing with interfaith dialogue, which moves us into some of the confusing comments for World Youth Day that have recently come from the soon-to-be Cardinal Américo Manuel Alves Aguiar of Lisbon. He has been quite outspoken on what we can expect from the gathering next month. What do you see there?
Look, I can see a bit of a theme happening here, Montse. Loquaciousness, and then the issue of what's actually underneath. So Cardinal-elect Aguiar has had to explain himself. He did so to the Portuguese language sister agency ACI Digital in a notable interview because it was notable for the sort of things he's talking about, but what is he actually saying? What's actually coming to light? What's the clarification here? Well, we hear that fraternity means that you respect each other's difference and that we don't want to proselytize, that we don't want to bring people to Christ in that way for the youth, for World Youth Day. But when we look at what St. John Paul II said about the World Youth Day and its purpose, it is, of course, to bring people to Christ. And there's a tension here that needs, again, just like we've spoken about in the other topics, the Synod on Synodality, the role of Archbishop Fernandez and the Dicastery of Faith, that needs clarifying, that will have to come out with more than just the wash, one might hope, as a Catholic, that will really show some results. In Lisbon, we will see these in only a few days' time when the World Youth Day kicks off.
Absolutely. And we know that interfaith dialogue does not mean watering down our faith and our principles. Well, one of the less talked about cardinal selections, really quick, is Archbishop Tsai Yuan in Hong Kong, whose comments are confusing in how they might be interpreted to characterize the plight of someone like Jimmy Lai, the prominent Catholic media leader who is still in jail. What might this appointment signal to us?
Spot on. Yet another aspect of that theme. Is it appeasement? What is he talking about and what is he saying? Is there some sort of diplomatic effort underneath? We're going to have to find out and we're going to watch it very closely in the coverage here on EOTN News. That's for sure, Montse.
Well, we'll be watching this closely indeed. Thank you so much, AC.
Much appreciated. God bless.
Representative Chris Smith of New Jersey is renewing his push to visit imprisoned Bishop Rolando José Álvarez in Nicaragua. Álvarez is outspoken about civil and human rights under the dictatorship of President Daniel Ortega. He was sentenced to 26 years in prison earlier this year. And at the beginning of this month, negotiations were underway to release and deport Álvarez, only to have Álvarez return to his maximum security cell the next day. Álvarez is being held in a prison known for torture.
Daniel Ortega has launched a massive persecution of the Catholic Church. He's done it by incarcerating not only bishops, priests, other clergy of religious orders, ousting so many others. And I've asked to go and meet with the bishop. I've not been told yes or no yet, but delay to me is denial. He's got to be released. You know, there needs to be more pressure, more appeals made by our government and by other governments and the Pope to release this tremendous group of clergymen, including the bishop.
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops issued a statement on Wednesday calling for the release of Álvarez, writing, "The consensus from the international community is clear. The continued incarceration of Bishop Álvarez is unjust and must end as soon as possible." This comes as Nicaraguan police detained another Catholic priest, Father Fernando Zamora, on Sunday in the capital, Managua. It's not clear what charges he faces. A former priest has been sentenced to 25 years behind bars on charges of rape and sexual assault. Stephen Sauer, who reportedly left the Jesuit order on his own in 2020, is charged with drugging and raping 17 adult men in and around New Orleans. Police say 61-year-old Sauer targeted tourists who were intoxicated and either lost or separated from friends. Detectives believe there could be more than 50 more unidentified victims. Police have arrested two people for vandalizing Catholic churches in New York City. A white marble statue of the Blessed Mother was spray-painted with black graffiti at Resurrection Church in Brooklyn. A 37-year-old man faces charges of criminal mischief and a hate crime. The diocese newspaper says parishioners actually caught him in the act. And a 22-year-old man in Queens faces charges of criminal mischief and vandalism for desecrating a church in June. The diocese says he threw the Eucharist on the floor, dressed up in priestly garb, and spread paint thinner on the basement. The same man returned to the church last week, acting erratically, and was arrested. EWTN News In Depth is back in a moment.
It's what St. Paul says. If Christ raised from the dead, then it is true. If Christ didn't rise from the dead, we're all wasting our time.
A controversial British politician explains what it's like to be a Catholic in an Anglican country and how his faith guides him in defending contentious political issues.
Pope Francis has nominated Bishop Nicholas Hudson, an auxiliary bishop for the Diocese of Westminster, to take part in the upcoming synod in October. Bishop Hudson, who assumed that role in 2014, led a team of four in-person delegates at the synod's European Continental Assembly meeting in Prague in February 2023. His leadership comes at a time when Christianity is on a decline in the United Kingdom. According to the most recent census of England and Wales from 2021, for the first time, less than half the population consider themselves Christian, with just 46% or 27.5 million people who describe themselves as Christian. And according to the 2019 edition of the British Social Attitudes Survey, which includes Scotland and Northern Ireland, Catholics make up just 7% of the population. The Church of England, which King Charles is the head of, broke away from the Catholic Church in the 16th century. While it's still the established religion of England, Catholics do continue to influence the political arena. Vatican correspondent Colin Flynn sat down with one distinctive and divisive Catholic in the UK Parliament. Here is Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg on the record.
Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, it is great to meet you and thank you for doing this interview.
No, it's an absolute pleasure, and thank you for inviting me.
Why did you get into politics originally?
So it's a very good question, and mixed reasons. That there is an element of public service. I think that if you are interested in politics and feel you can contribute something, particularly if you come from a fortunate background, you do have an obligation to do something in return, but I also enjoy it. So it's not, I wouldn't like to say it's all piety. It's actually, it's a fascinating thing to be involved in. I find it very rewarding and interesting.
Now, we are here today interviewing you for EWTN because of your strong Catholic faith. And you have always been outspoken about your faith and your beliefs, and citing the Catholic faith to defend very controversial and complicated issues, political issues, societal issues, and so on. Where does that strong faith come from?
Oh, it comes from my father via his mother, who was Irish-American and brought up with a very strong Catholic faith. And so, because some people are quite surprised that somebody who appears to be as English as I am isn't an Anglican, but
yes.
is in fact a good solid Papist. And that's through my father and, as I say, his mother.
What about through your formative years when you're looking at the world around you and young people are questioning everything and their place in that ever-changing world? In those years, did you look around and think, maybe this is hogwash, maybe this is a fairy tale?
No, I've never thought that. No.
When the scandals broke here in the United Kingdom, the sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, as they did in my neighbouring country, in Ireland, and in all many different parts of the world, did that rock your faith and belief in the church as an institution?
No, because all institutions are made up by individuals, and individuals are fallible. What are the words said aloud in the canon of the extraordinary form? Only words said aloud, nobis quoque peccatoribus, and us two sinners. Even the priest is admitting that he is a sinner. Because of course he is, because he's human. And we know that only Christ himself and Our Lady were without sin. And so, you know that, but that doesn't undermine the institution, which is Christ's institution.
In political life, how does your Catholic faith influence you?
Well, I'm very lucky. I think being a Catholic makes political life much easier because there is an authoritative body of teaching that I can point to if I'm asked about the moral questions, which are in British politics a free vote. And so if somebody says to me, what is your view on abortion, for example, I can say, well, the teaching of the church is, and I accept that as a Catholic. And why is this helpful? Well, it means that if people want to challenge my view, which of course they're entitled to do, and they do, they're not just challenging me, they're challenging the authority of the church, which is a much greater authority than I could possibly have.
There's much debate now around religious freedom and, as an extension, religious tolerance. But the case that was a big story here in the United Kingdom of the woman who was arrested for praying silently in her mind outside of an abortion clinic, I mean, that was a big story in the United States. They couldn't believe this. But something like that, does that worry you when you see that woman who wasn't shouting or protesting but yet was still arrested for praying in her mind?
I'm very worried about the freedom of speech issues more generally. I think this is part of a freedom of speech issue rather than a specifically religious issue. It is cropping up in a number of areas. We've had a recent argument about people having their bank accounts closed down because they had political views that the banks didn't seem to like. And so freedom of speech is coming up again and again, and that is a real challenge. I wish we had the First Amendment in the UK. It would make things much clearer.
Mm. Do you think the government got it wrong with that bill that has allowed like that lady to be arrested?
It was a free vote. Mm. So that's the problem. It's very interesting. When you look at the abortion issue, in opinion polls, 70% of women would like to see the limit for abortions reduced. In Parliament, it's almost an article of faith of the Labour Party that you should have almost abortion to full term. That the people arguing for decriminalisation, what they really mean is abortion to full term. And the left are much further away from where public opinion is than they think they are. But they are, unfortunately, a majority in the House of Commons.
When you look at the state of the Catholic Church in the United Kingdom today, what do you think?
What do I think? I think the Catholic Church is doing reasonably well. We've been hugely helped by so many people coming from Poland, which has swelled our numbers, which is a thoroughly good thing.
You mean in terms of attendance?
In terms of attendance and numbers. Okay. So we've got. Yeah. And if you look at some parts of the church, they're really doing very well. So if you look at the Brompton Oratory, it is full, and people seem to like rigorous Orthodox faith. The Institute of Christ the King, again, with rigorous Orthodox faith, doing very well and is getting lots of vocations, as they do at the Oratory.
Yeah, why do you think that is, that some areas of the Catholic Church in pockets are thriving, whereas the vast majority of the Church has seen a decline, a very steep decline?
Well, I think it's a question of doing things properly. I think where things are done properly, this is attractive to people. It's about truth. If the Catholic Church believes it is the holder of truth, it needs to be bold about this, doesn't it? And if it doesn't believe it's the repository of truth, well, what's it fussing about? So it's all down to the belief in truth.
As someone in political life, looking at society as a whole, what do you think the effect has been on society as we've seen the decline of religion?
I think there are problems. I think religion provides a very secure base for people's lives. I think that it is helpful for them in terms of their mental health. I think a religious faith gives people a purpose and a spiritual understanding of life that helps them mentally. I think it also encourages people to behave well, though I've always rather liked the line of Evelyn Waugh. People say to Evelyn Waugh, Mr. Waugh, how come you're such a difficult man when you're a Catholic? To which he replied, just think how much worse I'd be if I weren't. And I've always rather felt like that it helps us be a little bit better than we might otherwise be.
How has it helped you in your life?
Oh, it helps me in my life on a daily basis. Having a belief in something that is more important for the next life is extremely helpful in focusing on what matters in life.
Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg, thank you very much for doing this interview.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Up next, a look at an emotional voyage by the Holy Father that echoes the cornerstone of his papacy. We'll be right back. July 8th marked the 10th anniversary of Pope Francis's first pontifical trip. He visited a small island off Italy called Lampedusa. thousands of refugees and immigrants have struggled to reach it by boat, many losing their lives while crossing the Mediterranean. The Holy Father laid a wreath for the thousands who died in their desperate attempts to seek a better life. In our Images of the Week, a look back 10 years at a historic first trip, it previews a common theme that has marked Pope Francis's papacy, reaching out to the poor and marginalized. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to tune in next week, same time, same place, for stories important to your Catholic faith. See you then.